May it please the court, my name is Kathleen Hogan, registration number 19131. I am here today on behalf of the appellant Nancy Blair Noel. I'll be referring to her today as Ms. Noel. I will be referring to the appellee as Mr. Hartnett, simply for the sake of convenience, because that's how he's indicated he wants to be identified, and not as an indication that we think any legal determination has been made. This is a case in which the trial court was commendably eager to cut to the chase in terms of addressing the best interests of the child and the appropriate arrangements for the child, but unfortunately, in its haste to reach that paramount issue, the court failed, or in some instances refused, to make inquiries that would be necessary for it first to determine what standards should have applied and guided its consideration when addressing the arrangements for the child. And that's the reason for today's appeal. Just like a building needs a foundation, a court's orders need to be based on the appropriate law, the applicable legal standards, and that didn't happen here. As society evolves, we see human relationships of types that weren't known or weren't openly acknowledged in the past. The laws in Colorado have not always kept pace with some of those social changes. And as human relationships form and break down, we have sometimes the situation of the round holes of ceremonial marriage and common law marriage, and some square peg type relationships that don't fit into those defined categories. And what we have here is a proceeding which started as an attempt to sort of stuff one of those square pegs into a round hole. The relationship between Mr. Hartnett and Ms. Noel is exactly that kind of square peg. In this case, the situation is overlaid with the apparent expectation in Colorado that some formal and legal gender reassignment is possible. But presumably requires something more than simply self-identification. And unfortunately, the case law and the statutes are sparse on that subject. I've been unable to locate anything that directly addresses this situation. But we have at least a little hint of where the legislature envisioned this would happen. 25-2-115 identifies how a person in Colorado, a person born in Colorado as one gender, can achieve a change in his or her birth certificate, and it requires an order of a court of competent jurisdiction indicating that the individual has been through a sex change by surgical procedure. Now, that doesn't answer the issue in our case, because Mr. Hartnett wasn't born in Colorado. However, what we have is a situation where a court faced with what the judge was advised would be a dissolution of a common law marriage is presented with individuals who represent themselves as a man on one hand and a woman on the other, and the court was not informed that there was anything even remotely non-traditional about how they had reached that situation.
So let me ask you a couple of questions here, just to clarify our procedural posture. Excuse me. Implicit in your argument here, I guess, is that the marriage decree is based on or contains some implicit determinations that we have a man and a woman who entered a marriage and now they want to divorce and there are children. Is that correct so far?
That's correct. And the magistrate, at the time that she began this post-decree voyage, said, that's res judicata, I will not revisit that. And that's, I believe, one of the key errors in the foundation of what the magistrate did, for a number of reasons. One is, parties cannot simply confer subject matter jurisdiction on a district court in Colorado by misrepresenting their situation. And the next is, there is no circumstance under which the district court judge in dissolving this purported common law marriage knew that he was being asked to make a determination that would be treated as a determination of gender reassignment.
Okay.
And that is not an issue that's an implicit part of a dissolution of marriage. So before we ever get to what do we do about parties who participated in factual misrepresentations or at least incomplete misrepresentations, we've got the underlying issue that there is no circumstance where a district court judge dissolving a common law marriage believes that they are making a determination about gender reassignment. And so we do not have a race judicata situation as far as that goes.
That makes sense. So that to undo the dissolution decree, your party, your client here, filed a motion for relief under 60B, correct?
I believe so. Okay. And my client was proceeding pro se at the time, and so she may have inartfully stated her concerns.
Okay. Is it your position that the district court in its order that we are reviewing here, the order of August 2010, is it your position that the district court did or did not confirm or review the magistrate's determinations that were made in July of 2009?
You know, and this is an area where, again, we are victimized now with having to sort through a voluminous record. And my position is that the magistrate made determinations in July of 2009, which formed the foundation of her later orders in August and thereafter. My client did a timely motion for review of that July 2009 order that formed the foundation for everything that happened after that. And that motion for review was erroneously denied by the district court on the ground that she had not made a timely application.
I think it's clear that everyone agrees that that determination was erroneous, that the district court erred in that determination.
That's correct.
Okay, so in your view then, is this an implicit denial of the July determinations, or is this simply an erroneous deferral yet of those determinations? Is it your view that we've yet to have a review of those?
Well, I would suggest that by going on with the further proceedings with the magistrate and the district court then having said what it did in the review of the August 2009 orders, that we have an implicit denial.
Okay.
Although, you know, I have to be candid with the court. I can't say that I can point to anything in this voluminous record where we have a trial judge addressing exactly the kinds of issues that I'm talking to you about this morning.
I understand that. Okay. And those are my procedural questions for now.
Counsel, let me follow up on that a little bit. You mentioned earlier the issue of subject matter jurisdiction because and I want to make sure I understand your argument, taking that to its final extent, are you arguing that the court did not have subject matter jurisdiction when it entered the decree of dissolution of marriage?
That is exactly what I'm arguing, and here's why.
If that's what you're arguing,
yes.
Is the next step then, because the court did not have subject matter jurisdiction, that dissolution decree is void?
That's correct. But my position on appeal does not hinge only on that, because as I just discussed earlier, there is no time when that district court, whether it did or didn't have jurisdiction to dissolve the marriage, was making a gender reassignment determination. But with respect to the subject matter jurisdiction to dissolve a common law marriage, there is no question that there was no ceremonial marriage and no one represented to the court that there was. We have then the question of, was there a common law marriage? Because if there isn't a common law marriage, because these folks are not eligible to enter into a common law marriage, to find that the court had jurisdiction to dissolve it would be tantamount to saying that a district court can dissolve a relationship even if the relationship is not allowed either under the common law or under Colorado statutes. And when we're talking about, and again, we're hampered by the fact that there is no case law. JMH and Rouse talked about the scope of a common law marriage with an underage participant. Well, that's not exactly on point, except that it tells us that if we're talking about a common law marriage and what constitutes one, we've got to look at the common law. And so I believe that there needed to have been an inquiry as to whether, and if so, under what circumstances, a marriage of a transgendered female to another female was allowed at the common law. And if the answer is there was no common law recognition of such a relationship, then it follows that the court here can't dissolve such a relationship because there is no common law marriage of that kind.
Pardon me
for interrupting, Ms. Hogan, if I may.
Sir?
It sounds like what you want is a remand for fact-finding. Is that right?
Your Honor, I believe in part, yes, because it is our argument that the court applied the wrong standard in eventually making the parenting time decisions relating to this child.
And if I may interrupt you again, please. If that's what you want, and then is this the right vehicle for doing it, or is it the right vehicle going back and trying to say in the original divorce decree it shouldn't have been entered?
Well, my client did say in the original divorce decree that it shouldn't have been entered. And I beg your pardon, and we may be talking at cross purposes. She did not say that at the time of the original divorce, and I'm not suggesting that she did. She said that to the court afterwards. You know, we misrepresented this whole situation. It's time to come clean, and here's what the real facts are. I believe that simply remanding this for additional fact-finding, however, is going to put all of us right back here in fairly short order if there is not also some guidance on some of the issues of law.
Well, I guess one of the questions that I have, Judge Russell mentioned a 60B motion.
That's correct.
Isn't that the proper vehicle?
And that 60B motion was denied and deemed untimely.
Okay, but there was no ruling on its merits, was there?
You know, there was, I believe that as this, I'm tied up in the record for a moment, and trying to remember when the 60B motion was filed. I believe that motion was denied, Your Honor, although I certainly would defer to the record if that reflects otherwise.
However, it was denied by the magistrate.
Yes.
And the problem is that under the magistrate rules, the magistrate lacks authority to rule on a 60B.
We've got that issue as well.
So in this potentially, the 60B motion could yet be filed in the district court.
Theoretically, perhaps I can suggest that without some guidance from this court, it's not going to be well received if that takes place. And I would worry that my client would risk that not only would it be denied, but it would be deemed frivolous and groundless in light of the prior rulings of the district court. And I think before anyone sends anything back anywhere, it's important to have some guidance on the law in terms of if or when or how one becomes a man under the law for purposes of dissolution of marriage and paternity determinations and all of those related issues. And that's the key that was never decided. And we've got, you know, does it require an X chromosome? Does it require simply self-identification? Or is there something in the middle, which is what our birth certificate statute suggests? But we have no guidance. And that's really the key and the foundation on which everything else needs to be built. Thank you. I see that my time is up or virtually up. Thank you very much.
We call you back up here for some more questions.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Holly Hinton, 36317, on behalf of Mr. Hartnett, who's here with us today. Your Honors, I've listened to your questions, and it brings a lot to bear on what the main issue is with respect to the court's July 6, 2009 order. And that really probably is the crux of this this argument today. And I believe it should be parceled in two, one with respect to the marriage and one with respect to paternity. There were two motions filed prior to the relocation hearing being held after the relocation motion was filed. And one was a motion to declare the marriage invalid, and one was a motion to declare Mr. Hartnett's non-paternity, basically a declaration of non-paternity she was seeking. Those two motions were ruled upon in the July 6, 2009 order. So with respect to the questions about the invalidation of the marriage, I think it goes down a different track than with respect to the question about Mr. Hartnett's paternity. As we have argued, the question of Mr. Hartnett's paternity, we believe, is res judicata between the parties because of the child being born during the party's common law marriage. Now, nothing in the court statutes or the Colorado statutes or no case law indicates that a marriage between a post-transitioned male or a transgendered person and a person of the opposite gender is invalid. There's no prohibition against the marriage, and it's not looked at with respect or defined with respect to the Colorado Constitution, whereby a marriage is between a man and a woman. So I don't think that it is an invalid marriage or voidable, as Ms. Now believes. For that reason, I think that it's res judicata between the parties, because it was determined at the entry of the decree of dissolution. Likewise, a determination of paternity is implicitly determined upon an entry of a decree of a dissolution of marriage.
Can I take you back a step, counsel?
Sure.
I'm wondering if your argument doesn't conflate the merits of a review under 60B, an attack on the legitimacy of the judgment, and the I'm trying to think here. Forgive me. I want to go back and just review your logic here. You are saying that, and I think I agree, that implicitly in the court's decree is the view that these parties were married, that one was a man and one was a woman, that they are the parents of this child. Okay.
Yes.
Now, presumably a motion could be filed.
Yes.
Which would say, well, turns out not to be right. Turns out that one is not a man, so they were both women. And so on that basis, the motion would say we're going to argue that the decree is invalid, was void. Without getting into the merits of that argument, why isn't that argument available at some point?
With respect to invalidating the marriage?
Yes.
It is available.
Okay.
And I believe it's available pursuant to CRCP Rule 60B.
So it may yet be available.
Right. But Ms. Snell has presented that the marriage was invalid or due to a fraud upon the court. And Rule 60B requires that that any motion invalidating a judgment on that basis be made within 6 months after the entry of the judgment.
Agree.
And
so this would fly only if it were brought under 60B3.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Because she's also arguing, and I confirmed it with her, that the judgment is void because of the lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Which would be covered by 60B3.
Yes. And for purposes of, there's two parts to it. There's the res judicata part. And
what's res judicata?
Well, the parties cannot litigate the same an issue that's already been litigated.
Okay, so what has been litigated?
The marriage. The marriage and the determination that there was a marriage, the determination of paternity, and therefore an entry of a decree.
However, the issue of subject matter jurisdiction
and getting at subject matter jurisdiction because of the requirements of the Colorado Constitution and statutes that a marriage is a union between one man and one woman.
Yes.
That has not been litigated.
No, that has not been litigated.
No.
But there's also the issue of collateral estoppel, I believe, in this case. And when you reach an issue of collateral estoppel, it's not for the court to determine whether or not the judgment, and by judgment I'm speaking of the decree of dissolution, it's not the issue for them to decide whether it's right or wrong, or voidable or unvoidable. The purpose of collateral estoppel is to keep parties who invoke the jurisdiction, which arguably Ms. Nell did because she co-petitioned for this dissolution, from benefiting from the judgment, acquiescing to the judgment, and then turning around and trying to repudiate the judgment. And that's the purpose of equitable estoppel. So, Your Honors, you have the ability to determine that we don't have to reach a decision on the validity of marriage. We don't have to reach a decision on the void, whether or not the marriage is void. You can determine that the question was raised, but due to the fact that Ms. Now sought this court's jurisdiction, she cannot now take it back because it does not suit her interests.
But that would really depend on the resolution of factual issues that we generally don't take up in the first instance, right? I mean, estoppel would really be something that the trial court would decide first.
Yes.
Okay. And if estoppel was used in this instance, equitable estoppel was employed in this instance, wouldn't that be the same thing as the parties granting the court subject matter jurisdiction when it may not have had it?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it's about whether or not a jurisdiction is being granted. It's not whether parties have asked the court to do something and then decide later. Let me take a step back. Regardless of subject matter jurisdiction, because the court can equitably determine that this judgment will go forward based on the fact that they asked the court, initially the district court, to enter a decree of dissolution. You don't have to make a decision on subject matter jurisdiction, because it's not about whether subject matter jurisdiction was right or wrong. It's about a judgment. These parties asked the court to make a determination, relied on the judgment after they asked them to, and now is asking to void that judgment.
Just so let me understand the rest of your argument, your position is then that in the absence of any order invalidating the judgment, that the determinations that are implicit in the judgment may be relied upon for determining all these other issues, and so the relocation order can proceed on the assumption that Mr. Hartnett is the father and that everything is determined that way.
Yes.
Okay.
And part of, and the reason I say that it could be followed down two roads is because part of asking the court for entry of a decree of dissolution was also that the parties were asking for the court to allocate parental responsibilities. And parental responsibilities could go on a different track. Mr. Hartnett was presumed to be a parent pursuant to the separation agreement, pursuant to the parenting plan, and after the his paternity was adjudicated at the entry of the decree. Even if the marriage is void, his paternity was still established, and pursuant to the Uniform Parentage Act, his biology and its relationship to the child, his gender, is not a determining factor, and neither is his relationship with Ms. Now. So his marriage, whether voidable or not, is not a determining factor of his relationship with the child. And so under the Uniform Parentage Act, Mr. Hartnett is the child's legal father, whether it be because, as we believe, there was a common law marriage, or because he openly he accepted the child into his own home and openly held him out to be his own child with Ms. Now's encouragement. And his gender, even if this court, through legal wrangling, wants to determine his gender, he's still a legal parent of this child.
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel, but I recall the statute that talks about the sort of presumptions that you're discussing. It uses the word father, right?
Yes.
Okay. So doesn't that presume at some point a finding of father?
Yes. Well, the finding of, first, there was a finding of parentage, as we believe at the decree, and then in the magistrate's July 6, 2009 order. There was
I understand that's your position, but that particular statute that talks about those presumptions uses the word father.
Yes.
It doesn't say person, it says father.
Right? Correct. Okay. And that, that statute in one of the recent Court of Appeals cases has been applied to mothers as well. So even if he was deemed a mother,
wrote that opinion,
right? And that it is equally applicable to Mr. Hartnett whether or not a lower court adjudicates him man or woman, or voids the marriage, or invalidates the marriage.
I think I understand your position. So that you're saying that that as it stands, until the decree is invalidated, your client has certain rights as a parent, as a father under the decree. But your position is that even if the decree is invalidated, that is not conclusive on the determination of his rights as a parent under the UPA.
Correct.
Okay. That's a question, presumably, that we don't reach unless or until we announce that the judgment itself has been invalidated.
Correct. For purposes of determining the relocation motion, presuming that Mr. Hartnett is a legal parent, the best interest of the child standard was applied by the trial court in the relocation hearing, and that would have been the appropriate standard with the determination that Mr. Hartnett is a legal parent. His biology to the child doesn't change his relationship, and adoptive parents, or parents by judicial determination, are also have the same constitutional rights to care and control of their child as a biological parent does. So Ms. Knoll isn't afforded any constitutional presumptions elevating her above Mr. Hartnett's status as an equal parent.
So could I get you to address very briefly, at least, the attorney fee orders here?
The attorney fee orders at pursuant to the appeal?
Yes. No. Not the fees awarded on appeal, but the fees that were awarded against Ms. Knoll in the trial court. First, can you tell me procedurally how did that happen? When were those? When were the fees ordered?
The fees were ordered at the conclusion of the August 31st, 2009, September 1st, 2009 motion to relocate hearing. Mr. Hartnett had, and he had other counsel at the time, had requested them through both 1410-119 and 1317-102.
Had those fees been earlier ordered by the magistrate? In other words, was this a district court review of the magistrate's determination? This is just a de novo determination by the district court?
This determination was a de novo determination by the district court, or by the magistrate.
By the magistrate entered an order on November 30th, 2009.
Right. It was a 2009 order. It was based on the trial, the motion to relocate trial and hearing.
So that in November of 2009, the magistrate orders the fees.
Yes.
And then as part of its August 2010 order, the district court approved that order.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Did Ms. Knoll, when she sought review of the magistrate's determination, did she include a transcript of the proceedings that pertained to the attorney fee order?
No, she did not. She subsequently filed a motion for reconsideration of the order adopting the November 30th, 2009 order. So there was a November 2009 order. She sought review of that order. The district court entered the August 6th order, and she filed a motion to reconsider the August 6th order.
District court's
order. But she'd also already filed her appeal, noticed her appeal at that time. And so, and with that motion for reconsideration, she provided the transcript. Your Honors, I see I'm out of time.
Those are my questions. Anything else, Chairman? Thank you so much. Ms. Hogan. We'd like you, if you wouldn't mind, to address this attorney fee order. And while we're at it, I think, also in a similar posture, the review of the magistrate's determination on relocation. Am I correct in my view that when Ms. Knoll sought review of the magistrate's relocation order, that she did not present to the district court a transcript of the proceedings before the magistrate?
I believe that at the time, well, she sought review of many things in the district court, but I believe that at the time that she first sought review of the July 9th orders, that she did not at that time realize she needed to provide a transcript, and so that was not provided until a later time. However, the denial of that motion for review, the determination that review had not been timely sought was not based on whether she had or had not provided a transcript, and by that time I believe that she had. With respect to the court's question about the attorney's fees,
we have the July order, and I understand your position on that. Now let's talk about the proceedings before the magistrate in November of 2009, which was the relocation hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, when she went to the district court, did she bring a transcript of the relocation proceedings when she sought district court review?
I believe that Ms. Hinton was correct in the chronology about that. My client, pro se, didn't realize that she was obligated to provide the transcript and assumed that the court had some kind of service that did that. Once she realized that she, in fact, had to arrange that, she did.
So that the attorney fee and the relocation proceedings are basically hand in hand.
That's correct. And the attorney fee award, at least in part, I believe was based on a determination that the claims that Ms. Knoll was making in the trial court regarding the invalidity of the divorce and the non-binding determination regarding parentage was in fact frivolous and groundless, and I believe that was at least in part what prompted that attorney fee award. I know that was one basis on which those fees were claimed, and that was part of my reason for indicating to the court that I think if she goes back on a Rule 60 motion, she's going to get slapped with fees yet again.
I see what you're saying. Kipchupi, any last words, or are you?
Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. That concludes our argument for this morning. The court thanks both counsel for their helpful arguments. And the case is now submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.